Hi, guys. Here's my morning routine. First, I drink olive oil. Next, I take an ice bath. Ooh, feeling super healthy.
If your health advice sounds strange coming from a kid, maybe it's just strange. Cygnos pairs AI with a biosensor so you can track your body's unique responses to food, movement, and more in real time, helping you achieve your health goals. Get $10 off select plans at Cygnos.com, Cygnos.com, with code SPARK. Cygnos.
Mike had charisma. He was the type of person that just couldn't make you believe everything.
And the centerpiece of the entire web is the use of children for sex.
It was a stunning case that ultimately revealed the secretly perverse lifestyle Wesson had forced his family to lead.
It was more like an organized crime family.
According to Yahweh's law, that was just the way it was supposed to be.
One verse that said, if you don't like him, kill him. I really wish I could find him.
Welcome back to another episode of Seven Deadly Sinners, part two on the Franklin scandal, and eventually other similar cases I'll be covering in this series. I still don't know how many episodes it's going to be, so I hope you're strapped in, because this is certainly the longest series I've ever done, and in my opinion, one of the most important and fascinating. Not that they all aren't important, but this one is one of the only ones that has gone without any type of conviction or justice, and that also spiraled into other similar cases that we will hear about later. Maybe the reason why it never got the justice it deserved was because it was truly too big, too scary. And I think that's one of the main reasons, but I also think it's because predators know that their victim's shame is their greatest weapon. Many times, that's how they get away with abusing over and over again. And in the case of the Franklin scandal, they used shame, of course, but they also used outright threats and violence to keep their victims silent. For the victims who did come forward and the people who tried to help them, they were then publicly shamed and discredited. We undoubtedly failed as a society when it comes to the Franklin scandal. And in the case of Alicia Owen, who was literally put in prison for her unwillingness to back down and give in to the FBI's and grand jury's threats to recant, the evidence is overwhelming. Please continue to have an open mind. Even though I know this story is so horrible that it seems almost implausible, but again, let's let the evidence, facts, victim stories, and records, or tampered with records in some cases, speak for themselves. When we left Alicia Owen, she said she had been sexually assaulted by Omaha Police Chief Robert Wadman. Robert Wadman was a tall man from originally the Southern California area, and he had that look about him. Blue eyes, sandy hair, almost a disarming good old boy look about him. Looks can be deceiving, though, as we know what Wadman was truly up to, according to Alicia Owen and other victims and witnesses. The 41-year-old who abused Alicia was also married and the father of four children, three sons and a daughter. How could you have a daughter and then abuse someone else's little girl? Ugh, it just makes me sick. We also learned of Alan Bear, a wormy-looking Caucasian millionaire heir to a department store fortune who for years had been rumored to be having sex with teenage boys. Alan was also married. We will corroborate and hear of Alan's crimes in the next episode. But let me infuriate you for a quick second. While researching this, I came across Alan and his wife's bio, an induction by the University of Nebraska for their charity, the Alan and Marsha Bear Foundation in 2009. The blurb about them says this, quote, Alan and Marsha Bear Foundation, inducted in 2009. Born and raised in California, Alan Bear was a great-grandson of Jonas L. Brandis, founder of the Boston store that later became J.L. Brandis and Sons Department Store. In the 1950s, Bear moved to Omaha after serving in World War II. He was president of Brandis from 1974 until 1987, when he sold the business to Yonkers, Inc. Bear continued to own Brandis Food Service, which catered food and handled concessions at Ack, Sar, Ben, and elsewhere. He also started Alan Bear & Associates, an umbrella company for his many business interests, including Brandis Catering, Pears Coffee, Herman's Nuts, and South Roads Mall. Bear's passion was collecting businesses, and he was widely known for his success in turning around shaky enterprises. As an example, his purchase of the Omaha Lancers in 1988 ensured that the hockey team stayed in Omaha. Marcia Bear's family also had a tremendous impact on Omaha. Her father, Ted Miller, helped Father Flanagan raise the money to build Boys Town. The Allen and Marcia Bear Foundation donates generously to hundreds of Nebraska arts and educational agencies, as well as charities. End quote. Oh, that Boys Town mention is really going to bug in a little bit. Thank you, University of Nebraska, for honoring this scumbag. Anyway, the other names that keep coming up are Peter Citron. These are names that Alicia Owen and others alleged were at these parties and that they were abused by. Peter Citron, an Omaha World Herald columnist and prominent Nebraskan, who next episode we will hear that while his involvement in Franklin was covered up, he was actually arrested shortly after for a completely separate case of abusing two young boys. So, yeah, evidence. But that's for next episode. Obviously, there was Larry King, who we went into his backstory in the last episode. And we will meet more as this story unfolds, but I just wanted to spark your memory from the last episode. And if you're just jumping in now, I suggest you go back and listen to last week's episode so this all makes sense, and then come back to this one. Okay. Trigger warning for this entire episode. This episode contains graphic depictions of sexual abuse of children, rape, physical abuse, grooming, depictions of child sexual abuse material, violence, suicide, and potentially a murder. Please take care while listening. In taped testimony, Alicia Owen recounts to Gary Caradori, investigator tasked with looking into the Franklin scandal, her next encounter with Robert Wadman. And side note, in the tape, she becomes incredibly emotional at certain points, and Caradori has to stop the tape and take breaks for the poor girl. So after he assaulted her at the Twin Towers, Alicia Owen followed Robert Wadman's orders, and the 14-year-old girl went down to the department store owned by Allen Bear and picked out a black lace dress in a size 10, which cost $115, and placed it on hold. The next day, Robert Wadman parked outside her school across the street and waited to take her to lunch, as if it's some sort of fucking date. Ugh, he's 41, she's 14. He then took her to the well-known French cafe downtown. Owen recognized the owners and hostesses as people who attended Larry King's parties. And even more incriminating was that Owen knew that the restaurant was normally closed in the afternoons, but I guess it opened up especially for the chief of police and his victim. The hostess led them to a small private room, and they were seated. Wadman then handed her the dress she picked out from Allen Bear's department store. After ordering lunch, Owen claims that Wadman said he wanted to show her the wine cellar, but when they descended, she realized it was just a murky basement. She began to get very afraid that she was about to be raped when Wadman told her to get naked and try the dress on for him. She initially refused, but then felt bad that the dress was so expensive, so she gave in. And it's going to get much more graphic, sorry. Wadman then started grabbing at her breasts, then pulled his pants down and masturbated, eventually attempting to ejaculate on her. She dodged it, to which, according to John DeCamp's book, The Franklin Cover-Up, Wadman then got very angry that she drew back at his attempt to ejaculate onto her. In The Franklin Cover-Up, the account of the assault is a bit more graphic, but I think this is graphic enough to report on a 14-year-old's abuse. In Alicia Owen's taped testimonies, she describes more corroborated evidence of her experiences that will unfold as this story unfolds. And if it seems like I'm only covering the female victim stories, it's just the way I've chosen to tell the story, because next week we will begin a similarly heartbreaking journey into the young boys' abuse and its connection to Boys Town, Nebraska, which became a mining field for these sexual abusers. Boys Town, being one of the most holy places in America, was anything but. When Larry King and others corrupted it. Are you like me, and when you get super into a podcast, you just have to know what the people looked like or what the crime scene looked like? Well, now you don't have to do the heavy lifting, because this cool new app called Votacast has done the heavy lifting for you. Votacast is an amazing new immersive podcast app that will allow you to experience this podcast and others in a way you haven't been able to until now. Votacast will provide you a deeper version of the show and allow you to view photos of the people and places we're talking about in this episode. You'll also get links for articles about the case. When you experience a podcast on Votacast, you not only will be listening to your favorite podcast, but you'll be digging into stories that will come alive with supplemental digital content that allows you to have everything being discussed in the episode at your fingertips. I mean, like I said, if you're like me, after you listen to a podcast, you search for more details, photos of the people, events discussed in the episode. With Votacast, it's all right there for you. So try Votacast out today. Click on the link in my show notes to learn more about Votacast, or download the app today in the App Store and change the way you experience podcasts forever. That's Votacast, V-O-D-A-C-A-S-T. Eulise Washington was in third grade when she and her two younger sisters were adopted. It was 1977, and Nebraska authorities had found their mother unfit to raise the three girls due to her heroin addiction. Eulise, Tracy, and Tasha were taken in by Jarrett and Barbara Webb, in addition to the couple's three foster children and two other adopted children, Wally and Robert. From the outside, it was a picture-perfect situation. Jarrett worked for the Omaha Power District and sat on the Franklin Credit Union Board of Directors. A well-respected couple, they lived in a picturesque ranch house on rolling acreage, 20 miles north of Omaha, that had been in Barbara's family for three generations. Barbara's family had founded the first orphanage for African American boys, Oakview Home for Boys. Barbara once told a reporter, quote, "My grandmother never made a difference between all the children that she raised. To her, a child was a child. Being with her and my grandfather taught me so much about love." How sweet, rehearsed, picture perfect. But looks can be deceiving. Eulise recalled that on the first night in the Webb home, her younger sisters were scared. They were crying. One of the girls, Peter Pants, and as punishment, Barbara tied the young girl to a doorknob and left her there all night. There were constant beatings, as corroborated by all the siblings and documented by social services. There were whips, rubber hoses, electrical cords, and a black strap called a railroad prop, made of black rubber and perforated with holes. Quote, "They beat us all the time. I took most of the abuse so they wouldn't beat Tracy and Tasha," recalled Eulise in the book The Franklin Scandal by Nick Bryant. The beatings would occur without warning, and sometimes Eulise was forced to attend functions at North Omaha Girls Club, where Larry King was president. She said the gatherings gave her the creeps. She recalled the functions always being attended by scores of older men, and they would seemingly salivate over the young girls in attendance. "This gives me the creeps now even hearing about it." Eulise also found out that Larry and Barbara shared more sinister bonds than just blood. She witnessed a handoff between the two of a stash of video cassette tapes that were left in the Webb's bedroom. When Barbara and Jarrett left one day and forgot to lock their bedroom door, she and some of her siblings found the tapes and discovered they contained videos of teenagers engaging in sex. They also found pornographic material tucked in the Webb's dresser drawers. Even their own school wasn't a safe refuge. Barbara and Jarrett had made friends with so many of the administrators that when social services would document one of the kids showing up with marks or welts on their body, administrators would cover for the web saying the kids were lying. Unbelievable. Even more unbelievable is the article that ran in the Omaha World Herald in 1983 that cultivated the image of the Webbs as the perfect parents. It was entitled, "Making the Best of It, A House Full of Kids." It depicted Barbara and Jared as parents of the year. The devoted, selfless, loving Webbs were pictured as almost heavenly figures, surrounded by their fostered and adopted children. The author of the article had seemingly fallen for Barbara's bullshit, or perhaps, you know, remember that the author could have been Peter Citron himself, and also that the Omaha World Herald publisher was also tight cronies with Larry King, Harold Anderson. But soon after Barbara, wouldn't you know it, she was awarded Foster Care Mother of the Year and was presented the award in Lincoln, Nebraska by the Nebraska governor himself. The Washington sisters were baffled and even began to question their own perception of the Webbs until the coat incident. The coat incident. Kevin and Wally, the Webbs' other two adopted children, were awakened one night in the middle of the night by Barbara and Jared, demanding to know who had ripped Kevin's jacket. Neither boy would admit to it and didn't know how it had happened in the first place. Kevin was then ordered to strip. Jarrett then cracked Kevin over the head with a screwdriver before being thrown up against the ceiling and being beaten with the railroad prop. Kevin then confessed to the offense to make the beating stop. 10 days later, the boys fled to the neighbors because the Webbs were constantly beating them. The neighbor's son told his mother, who phoned the sheriff, who paid a visit to the Webbs. Kevin and Wally voiced their reluctance to talk but told the sheriff of the repeated beatings. Barbara, of course, denied the allegations and said the welts were just a result of spankings. Child Protective Services took Wally and Kevin into custody and took Kevin to the hospital, where a doctor said the welts were likely caused by a heavy rubber hose. CPS returned to the Webbs the following day, where all of the children said that Kevin was lying. They'd been threatened by Barbara to keep the family secrets. The primary concern of CPS was the foster children, so they were removed from the home, along with Wally. The adopted children were allowed to stay, and the Webbs weren't charged with anything. Wally became a ward of the state. Eulise managed to find her biological grandmother, Opal, in 1985, despite the Webbs' best efforts, and fled to her home in Omaha. She told the Webbs she would only return if her sisters could visit their grandmother. Tracy and Tasha stayed with their grandmother for a few days and opened up to her about the physical abuse they had endured. Opal placed a call to the Omaha Police Department, but they stated it was out of their jurisdiction. When Opal attempted to return the girls to the Webbs at their arranged rendezvous point, the Webbs didn't show up. Upon returning to Opal's home, the Omaha Police Department was there, alleging that Opal had kidnapped the children. Would you expect anything less from Barbara and Jared at this point? Social services said upon returning to the Webb home, the girls were pushed into chairs and screamed at, quote, "You're dead to us," and called bitches and whores, and made to scrub the entire house clean the entire night and into the morning. The Webbs then suddenly wanted to relinquish their custody of Eulise and Tracy because they were, quote, "uncontrollable." 1 month later, a petition was filed to make the girls wards of the state. Eulise and Tracy were ultimately placed in the home of Ronald and Kathleen Sorensen, who had taken in Wally and Kevin prior and witnessed firsthand the abuse they had endured. The first weeks in the home were joyful, but they frequently expressed concerns for their little sister Tasha. Then, after a month or so, Eulise seemed very upset. She began to talk about a friend who had been raped by her father and also began to talk about orgies. Kathleen had earned Eulise's trust, and Eulise opened up to her more and more, admitting Jared had molested her repeatedly. Kathleen alerted social services immediately. The girls then met with their guardian ad litem for the first time, Patricia Flocken. Their allegations of abuse were eerily similar to the ones Wally had made. Patricia was also his guardian. The girls also talked about being terrified of the Webb's lawyer, and they also mentioned being terrified of the Webb's cousin, Larry King. Though at the time, Patricia had never heard of him. Another quick trigger warning here. Eulise said she was initially molested after living in the Webb home for approximately a year. The first time, she was between the ages of 9 and 10. and she was made to take a nap with Jarrett, and he played with all the parts of her body. When Barbara wasn't home, Jarrett would threaten her with whipping if she wouldn't accompany him to his bedroom. Ulias started threatening to tell Barbara. He said he would hurt her if she would tell Barbara. In subsequent testimony, Ulias told authorities that he didn't molest her from ages 12 to 15 because of her threats to tell Barbara. But when she was 16, Jarrett walked into her room and ordered her to remove her clothes. As she lay face down on the bed, he pelted her with the railroad prop. Ulias told authorities she was willing to take a polygraph, and the polygraph showed she was telling the truth. The county attorney Tripp believed she had rehearsed so intently that she believed what she was saying was true, and he opted to not file abuse charges against Jarrett Webb. Again, unbelievable. And side note, she also passed 3 other polygraphs, but no one believed her. Finally, Tasha and Robert were taken out of the Webb home and placed in the foster home of Jerry and Patricia Rothmeyer, a few blocks from the Sorensons. The pair had developed a habit of hoarding and hiding food, and they said they no longer wanted to live in the Webb household because the beatings would continue. Tasha said she was forced to perform oral sex on an uncle, and even though Barbara knew about her being molested, she did nothing. The Rothmeyers immediately reported this to the caseworkers, but a judge ruled that the children would be returned to the Webbs with a rehabilitation plan. A judge ordered the Webbs and the kids to undergo counseling and psychotherapy. Why were they returned there? Tasha and Robert were ultimately removed from the home in the fall of 1986, and the Webbs relinquished all of their parental rights, denying all allegations. The kids, like the others, were deemed uncontrollable. Once again, Jarrett and Barbara Webb evaded child abuse charges, though there were pages and pages of documentation with corroborating evidence of abuse. Various agencies that documented the abuse and willful neglect seemingly turned a blind eye. But why? Well, there's speculation that the FBI might have been in bed with the Webbs. Maybe literally. One particular social caseworker had a very bad feeling about the Webbs case and took it upon herself to make inquiries. They found that many of the case files were missing and said FBI agents contacted her and said it would be in her best interest to forget about the info. Patricia Flocken thought her phones might have been tapped and felt at times she was under surveillance. Ulias began to open up more and more to Kathleen Sorensen and described charter flights Larry King had orchestrated with Ulias and other children. One to Chicago in the fall of 1984, and one to New York City in the spring of 1985. Ulias was forced to wear lingerie and attend orgies, and that there were Boys Town students on the flights, and Ulias recognized a prominent politician in the mix. Does this have something to do with potential FBI involvement? Is this why the Webbs were never charged? Is there a political bent to all of it? Is Ulias the cog to tie it all together? The missing link? There are many missing links and many cover-ups. Most of you have probably heard me sing the praises of Pros, the world's most personalized hair care. And for those that haven't, I want to tell you about the incredible results I'm seeing since using my customized Pros products. Okay, so just 2 weeks ago, I got my hair bleached again. I just can't quit the bleach bottle, apparently. But my hair is looking healthier than ever, even after that possible damage. Because Pros has improvements in my hair texture, shinier, smoother, softer, stronger, everything, because they customize the product specifically for me, including down to my preference of smell and fragrance. Pros knows there is more to you than just your hair type. Pros has given over 1 million consultations with their in-depth hair quiz, which is how I got started. And I just found it, frankly, fascinating. They take into account everything from your zip code so they know what kind of weather you're in, your eating habits, how much you exercise. Do you exercise outside? What is your hair texture? Mine is fine. So they gave me a Pros formula to kind of give me some more body. By analyzing over 85 personal factors, Pros determines a unique blend of ingredients to treat your exact concerns. Prose also has a review and refine feature. It lets me tweak my formulas for any reason, like change of address, hair color, or diet. For example, once I put in that I'm bleaching my hair, they gave me a lightly tinted purple conditioner that helps my hair from getting brassy. As a carbon neutral certified B Corp, Prose is an industry leader in clean and responsible beauty. All of their ingredients are sustainably sourced, ethically gathered, and cruelty-free. They're also the first custom beauty brand to go carbon neutral. And if you're not 100% positive Prose is the best hair care you've had, they will take the products back, no questions asked. Prose is the healthy hair regimen with your name all over it. Take your free in-depth hair consultation and get 15% off your first order today. Go to prose.com/sinners. That's prose, prose.com/sinners for your free in-depth hair consultation and 15% off. Sadly, Ulysse's account of attending events at the Omaha Girls Club wouldn't be the only accounts of pandering and cherry-picking children from there and other institutions in this case. Enter a few more names. Kirsten Hallberg was a close friend of Kathleen Sorensen, both working in the field of child welfare. Kirsten was present during some of Ulysse Washington's recollections about Larry King's organized child exploitation ring. And so when she met 12-year-old Shanetta Moore while working her job as a resident advisor at Utah-Hawley, a residential psychiatric facility in Omaha for adolescent girls, in June of 1986, she was primed to ask the necessary questions and be a listening ear to the young girl when she raised the red flag of Larry King once again. During Shanetta's intake, she mentioned attending the Omaha Girls Club for a time. When Hallberg heard that, she asked if she knew of the Webb sisters. Upon saying that, the 12-year-old girl nervously blurted out that she was involved in a child prostitution and pornography ring, though she didn't mention Larry King by name at the time. Because of Ulysse, now Washington and Tracy Webb's accounts of the girls' club headed by Larry King and their experiences, she had an inkling that it might be the same ring. After blurting this out, she then became extremely scared and warned Hallberg to just leave it alone. It was too dangerous for her or anyone to look into. And Shanetta had clear reason for this fear. First of all, she was brought into this cast of gremlins using the children's group, the girls' club, to procure kids when she was just 9 years old. And second of all, according to Nick Bryant's book, The Franklin Scandal, after Shanetta said, quote, that she had been involved in a prostitution and pornography ring, Shanetta said that she attempted to break away from the ring, and when she did, her mother was raped in reprisal, end quote. After Moore's startling revelation, she became withdrawn and extremely frightened. Moore's account of her mother's rape is corroborated by an OPD report, again quoting from Nick Bryant's book. At around 3 a.m. on June 15, 1986, Moore's mother was in bed sleeping when a short, thin African-American man wearing a nylon stocking over his face slipped into her bedroom, put a butcher knife to her throat, and in a high-pitched voice said, "Where's Shanetta?" After the rape, the police were phoned. But the responding officers told Moore's mother that she needed to collect herself and then phone the OPD if she wanted to make a complaint. Moore's mother phoned the OPD the next day, and the sergeant, who initiated a follow-up investigation, noted that the responding officers didn't even write a police report, take the victim to a hospital, or contact the crime lab. And, unbelievably, they advised Moore's maternal grandfather to fix the door that the perpetrator had broken to enter the house. The assailant was never apprehended. After Moore discussed her mother's rape, Hallberg attempted to probe her for specific information, but Moore said the ring had too much power, and if she made any further disclosures to Hallberg, they would both be in danger. Moore then shut down emotionally and refused to discuss the ring any further. End quote. Shanetta Moore did have a reason to be deathly afraid. Moore became very close with Kristen Hallberg, her resident advisor. And even after being discharged from Utah-Hawley, Moore stayed in contact with Hallberg, who, by the way, was fired from Utah Holly for, quote, becoming too close with some of the patients and for reporting the abuse to the police. Conveniently, Alice King, Larry's wife, sat on the board of the facility. After leaving Utah Holly, Shanetta Moore moved back in with her mother and attended an alternative school. It was there that she began confiding in her counselor. She called Hallberg one night and said that she had told her counselor all about her abuse, and the counselor wanted to meet with Hallberg to talk about next steps and how to help the child. The three were set to meet, but that evening, Moore called Hallberg and sounded desperate and suicidal. Hallberg then phoned the counselor, who, despite it being potentially unethical, but knowing that Moore's mother likely had no idea why her daughter was in such a panic, the counselor suggested Hallberg go see Moore and ask her mother if she could take her home for the night to calm her down so they could meet with the counselor tomorrow. Moore's mother consented, and that night, Moore explained to Hallberg that she, quote, wanted to end her life because it would be far less painful than if they, quote, decided to murder her. The next morning, while in the counselor's office, the counselor explained to Hallberg that Moore had told him everything about the abuse she had suffered and of Larry King. The counselor and Hallberg thought it would be best to hospitalize Moore for her own safety, as she was still in a suicidal state. They called her mother for consent, and the counselor also revealed her daughter's allegations to her. Hallberg was stunned Utah Holly hadn't already done this, and Moore's mother confirmed the facility never disclosed to her anything of the sort. It was at Richard Young Hospital that Moore began to open up even more. She was given a psychiatric evaluation by psychiatrist Kay Schilling, who gave her a physical and mental evaluation and concluded that while Moore was dealing with, quote, major depression with suicidal ideations, and that Moore's, quote, self-esteem is very low based on her belief that suicide was the only way to correct her problems, Dr. Schilling concluded that Moore was not delusional or even in a state of psychosis. She was a completely lucid young girl dealing with the aftermath of abuse and the fear of their wrath. During her time at Richard Young Hospital, she revealed her life story to its caregivers. Shanetta Moore was raised by a single mother for most of her life, though she had a good relationship for a short time with her mother's boyfriend. The relationship between the boyfriend and her mother soured, and it was eventually just her and her mother again. Shanetta began attending the Omaha Girls Club, of which Larry King was president when she was 9 years old. It was at the age of 9 when she was first approached by a man who went by the name Ray at the Omaha Girls Club. It was the winter of 1983, and the older man named Ray, who she described as average height, overweight, around 40 years old, African American, who would frequent the Girls Club, had become friendly with some of the girls. Moore stated that he eventually began to take the girls off-site to an abandoned building to essentially party. Shanetta claims the first time she was driven from the girls' club to hang with Ray, he passed around a joint that they all smoked and talked with the girls, and she was among 4 or 5 other girls she knew of that would go with Ray. The meetings became more frequent, and Shanetta claims that each time, Ray would blindfold the girls during the drive so they wouldn't know where they were going. He got the girls to smoke weed, and then after a few of these trips, he brought them to their first quote-unquote party. Shanetta says that the party was filled with men in their mid-30s, and she was now 10 at this point. Ick. She said the men got her and the other girls to drink and take drugs with them. The men would get the girls, quote, wasted. Yeah, that's great. They're 10, you fucks. Ugh, God. And then they would begin to sexually abuse them. Shanetta says that the girls didn't have a choice of who they would have sex with. They were just sitting ducks, essentially. Again, she's 10 years old. She shouldn't even have to make that choice, let alone be chosen. It's just horrible. She attended the parties for about 6 months and names Larry King as one of the partygoers at least one of the gatherings. This was when she began to act out in her mother's mind, which made her mother feel completely mind-boggled. How could a 10-year-old find a way to disappear and be gone for nights at a time? She stayed living with her mom and attending the Omaha Girls Club, but after a few years of her uncontrollable behavior, 12-year-old Shanetta eventually wound up at Utah Holly the residential psychiatric facility where she met Hallberg. Because her mom didn't know what to do anymore, she threw her hands up and Shanetta became a ward of the state. Sadly, had her mother known, she would have been able to reconcile with what was going on with her daughter and the connection to her own rape. Shanetta, too afraid and too young to have the capacity to know she was being completely victimized, didn't tell her mom what was happening to her. Shanetta was smart and brave, but understandably, a little kid doesn't know how to get out of something that grown men are forcing her into. And not only did she not know how to get out of the ring and away from the abuse, she was outright threatened that they would kill her, her family, or torture other children in her name if she ever spoke. I will briefly state that she does give allegations of satanic abuse. But because that is such a hotly debated topic, and because her story has been corroborated enough on its own without that added scrutiny, I'm going to leave it out. If you want to learn more about it, you can read either John DeCamp or Nick Bryant's books on the Franklin scandal. Again, which much of this research has been pulled, I just don't want to get into the satanic ritual abuse part. In taped confessions by other victims, though, which aired in the documentary Conspiracy of Silence, they do speak of sadistic sexual acts performed on them and of being burnt with cigarettes, tied up, sodomized, the list goes on. Essentially, the abuse doesn't even need to be part of a satanic ritual to be utterly devastating and disgusting. Many of the victims do allege the satanic ritual abuse they suffered, and it may have been, and then it may have just been that that's the way the children perceived it. Either way, the great lengths authorities went to cover up Larry King's underage pornography and prostitution ring are astounding. Other quick side note, I do know that those are both outdated terms, but this was what was referred to in the 1980s. Conspiracy of Silence, by the way, was a documentary that was inexplicably banned and pulled from seeing the light of day right as it was set to air, even appearing in TV guides announcing its air date. Basically, in 1993, a film crew from Yorkshire Television in the UK, traveled to Omaha, Nebraska, to make a documentary about the alleged pedophile ring. The film was funded by the Discovery Channel and includes interviews from victims, John DeCamp, witnesses such as social service workers, politicians and lawyers, law enforcement, and journalists from the Washington Post, who all had credible evidence to believe these victims and were fighting to expose the nationwide pedophile ring that kidnapped and or delivered children, mostly orphans, many of which were picked up from Boys Town, the most holy and famous Catholic orphanage in the country, and maybe even the world. Like I said before, I'll be doing at least half an episode to an entire episode on Boys Town, and the victims Nick Bryant tracked down and their unflinching stories of the disgusting and corrupt abuse they suffered at the hands of Larry King, Alan Bear, Peter Citron, a counselor at Boys Town they confided in, a priest they confided in, most of which were later convicted of child sexual abuse completely separate from the Franklin scandal. Again, the evidence is there. Anyway, the documentary shows the victims' stories of being delivered to the rich and powerful for the purposes of molestation, drug trafficking, and blackmail. Conspiracy of Silence was set to air in 1994. But like I said, right at the last minute, the Discovery Channel pulled it and reimbursed Yorkshire Television the $500,000 it cost to make. It did get leaked on YouTube, though, and I think you'll have a very similar reaction to me if you watch it. Absolute shock and revulsion that this happened, was covered up, and that more than one person trying to help these kids died mysteriously. Fine, I think they were murdered. There's no other way to sum it up. And a story I'll be closing this episode out with, so you don't have to wait much longer for it, might prove that for you. So during the bizarre and extremely shady grand jury hearing looking into this, Moore was ripped to shreds, not believed, and discounted. But if even one small part of her story is true, something happened. Both Shanetta Moore, Elise Washington, testified before the grand jury. Well, Nick Bryant was never able to track down their testimonies. When he interviewed Elise later while writing his book, she said she never recanted her statements. And what she says today is what she said then, and her story has never changed. And like I mentioned earlier, with Kathleen Sorensen as a witness, she testified that she witnessed Ulise pass 4 polygraph tests, yet no one was ever charged for her abuse. The grand jury handling of the Franklin scandal seemed to have 2 approaches to their game plan in snuffing out the story. Attack all victims' credibility, attack all witnesses, social workers, and investigators looking into its credibility, and then refuse to investigate legitimate resources for evidence. For example, Larry King's flight logs, and then give 0 explanation as to why not. We will be going into their exact bizarre cover-up later, but to end this episode, let's look into the flight log fiasco and tell the story of the late Gary Caradore and how his crusade to help these victims and expose the Franklin cover-up ended his life.
Hi guys, here's my morning routine. First, I drink olive oil. Next, I take an ice bath. Ooh, feeling super healthy.
If your health advice sounds strange coming from a kid, maybe it's just strange. Cygnos pairs AI with a biosensor so you can track your body's unique responses to food, movement, and more in real time, helping you achieve your health goals. Get $10 off select plans at Cygnos.com, Cygnos.com, with code SPARK. Cygnos.
Listen, I'm never going to stop saying it. I am obsessed with HelloFresh. With HelloFresh, you get fresh, pre-measured ingredients and mouth-watering seasonal recipes delivered right to your door. Skip the trips to the grocery store and count on HelloFresh to make home cooking easy, fun, and affordable. And that's why it's America's number one meal kit. So I'm loving that in the summertime when it's like kind of too hot to cook a bunch, I can use their quick and easy meals, 15 to 20 minute dinners, breakfast on the go, and 10 minute lunches in HelloFresh Market. And it's perfect for when I'm super busy and when I just don't want to cook. And you can also, when you are in the mood for a fancy meal, you can enjoy restaurant quality meals for less in the comfort of your home. HelloFresh's gourmet recipes like balsamic fig sirloin are over 72% cheaper than an average restaurant meal, according to Zagat's Dining Survey. And they taste just like a restaurant meal. Eating healthier has never been easier with low-cal, carb-smart, vegetarian, and pescatarian options every week. And no matter what you choose, every single recipe is packed with fresh produce sourced directly from farmers. And you can easily change your delivery days or food preferences and skip a week whenever you need. And feeding the whole family has never been easier with larger box sizes for more servings and more savings. When my future in-laws were visiting, I quickly went online and I changed the box that week to accommodate 2 more people. And by the way, I also got them hooked on HelloFresh, and now they are HelloFresh devotees. So try HelloFresh for yourself. I'm telling you, you won't regret it. Go to HelloFresh.com/Sinners14 and use code Sinners14 for up to 14 free meals plus free shipping. So go to HelloFresh.com/Sinners14 and use code Sinners14 for up to 14 free meals plus free shipping. HelloFresh, America's number one meal kit. Quote, "If even half of what I have heard is true, this is the biggest thing to ever hit Nebraska," end quote. This is what Gary Caradore told his wife Sandy one late night in August 1989. Gary Caradore was born April 15, 1949, in a small town outside of Omaha, to Lino and Mary Caradore. Lino was a teacher at Boys Town, and Mary was a stay-at-home mom. Gary would later state that because of his close affiliation with Boys Town and how much he had admired and exalted the institution, he was heartbroken to hear of its corruption when working on the Franklin scandal. Gary met his future wife Sandy Anderson his first day of his freshman year of high school. Love at first sight. And they married right after high school and had their first son, Sean, who was born in 1974, and Andrew James, who also went by the nickname AJ, who was born in 1981. Gary joined the Coast Guard, and he was sent to Alaska, where his duties included handling teletype messages and directing aircraft. In 1969, he spent 1 year in Vietnam and then was honorably discharged by the Coast Guard in 1971. He joined the Nebraska Highway Patrol, and he so impressed his supervisors that at the young age of 23, he was promoted to the Nebraska State Patrol's Criminal Division and became one of the youngest to ever hold the title of NSP investigator. He continued honing his skills in education and enrolled in several FBI training programs, including ones on snipers, bomb threats, and hostage school, criminal investigation photo lab school, and sex crime investigation. He left in 1977 in good standing to become a private investigator, and he eventually founded the company Caracorp, which had contracts with many big corporations. He also had a passion for tracking down abducted children and teens stuck in a pattern of drugs and prostitution who were being exploited. So when Senator Schmidt paid him a visit to explain what the Franklin Committee was investigating, Gary said yes to the interview, and within hours was hired as the new investigator for the Franklin Committee. The committee, tasked with looking into the Franklin Credit Union and Larry King's financial crimes, which amounted to him stealing over $40 million, and the alleged sexual abuse crimes, Gary would soon become utterly shocked by the enormity and wide-reaching corruption that he was tasked to investigate. Gary appointed and assigned Karen Ormiston to be his sidekick in the investigation. They had worked together for years on investigations and had a great rapport and synchronistic investigative style. Almost immediately after being hired to investigate, though, bizarre occurrences and threats began. Sandy and Gary had a friend that worked at the Lincoln Telephone Company who came to their house to inform them that their phones were tapped. Gary wasn't surprised, though, and according to Nick Bryant's book, Gary's wife said that Gary said, quote, he'd already suspected that it was the FBI, because when he arranged meetings over the phone, FBI agents would already be at the designated place when he arrived. Two intruders also broke into their home when the couple was out to dinner, and their two sons were sleeping at home. Gary was undeterred, though. He began to find informants and leads. He would go out on the streets, into bars, talk to people who had information, and then corroborate and cross-reference those stories, and soon had a pretty good picture that the rumors that Larry King was abusing children had been going on for a long time and were seeming more and more credible. He made copies of documents that showed that Larry King was chartering flights almost every week all over the country, but his favorite destination was Washington, D.C. Gary himself was an accomplished pilot and understood how flight records worked, so he found it strange that when he came across Larry King's flight receipts, it rarely listed passengers or would merely list Larry King. Caradori contacted the first charter service out of Ohio for more records, but they demanded a subpoena. This being out of the jurisdiction of Nebraska, he was unable to get one. The second charter service Gary contacted in 1989, Caradori made contact with the pilot of the second charter service frequented by King. And from Nick Bryant's Franklin scandal, he says, quote, the pilot informed Caradori that he had piloted King, two teenage boys, and a teenage girl to Los Angeles. Caradori phoned another pilot from the same charter service who acknowledged that minors accompanied King on flights. In a later investigative report, Caradori described his meeting with former employees of a third charter service used by King. Though the woman was apprehensive about having her name connected to the Franklin investigation, she disclosed that King used her charter service on a weekly basis. She said he routinely traveled with a number of young men, quote, very good looking, dressed in fancy suits, clean cut, clean shaven, but she remarked that the young men never spoke, which she found strange. Caradori and Ormiston called on a fourth charter service, patronized by King, located in Sioux City, Iowa. They met with the company's chief executive, who instructed his secretary to direct them to a basement room where their records were stored. Caradori and Ormiston then began to burrow through the company's countless records. Caradori must have felt like a miner striking gold when he found Franklin Credit Union itineraries listing children whose names had surfaced during his investigation. As Caradori continued to burrow, Ormiston snatched the itineraries and darted to a nearby copy machine. When Caradori scanned the itineraries, he came across one that had a sticker on it denoting a previous FBI inquiry. When Caradori and Ormiston were on the verge of leaving the charter service with their newfound cash, the company's chief executive barged into the room and demanded that they leave without the copied itineraries. Caradori grudgingly acquiesced to abandoning the itineraries. But they were a sterling lead that has his tenacious disposition was disciplined to relinquish without a fight. Because the Franklin Committee's subpoenas lacked authority in Iowa, he phoned his NCUA contact in D.C. and implored him to authorize a federal subpoena for the company's flight itineraries. The NCUA official consented to subpoena the charter service's records. As Caradori awaited the prized itineraries, he was slapped with a federal subpoena that demanded he surrender Franklin evidence to the FBI. Caradori found the subpoena to be particularly vexing because the committee routinely surrendered its evidence to the state and the federal authorities. He nonetheless complied with the subpoena and delivered a bundle of files to Omaha's FBI headquarters. He glanced at the desk of the FBI agent receiving the files, and he noticed a stack of documents from the charter service in Sioux City, Iowa. Weeks later, Caradori walked into Senator Schmidt's office at the statehouse. Schmidt was talking on the phone, but handed him a large envelope containing the subpoenaed itineraries. Caradori leafed through the itineraries and quickly realized that they had been altered. All of the incriminating information relating to the interstate transportation of children had been deleted. End quote. We will talk much, much more about Gary Caradori and his sharp investigative efforts and fight for these victims. But in the interest of not making this a two-hour-long podcast, I'm going to skip ahead to what happened to Gary and his poor little innocent son, very likely, in my opinion, and many others, as a result of investigating this case. Insert Rusty Nelson. During Gary Caradori, John DeCamp, and Nick Bryant's investigations of the Franklin scandal, they all came across a man named Rusty Nelson, a very confusing and controversial figure. Rusty Nelson was the self-admitted photographer for Larry King's nationwide pedophile ring. He claimed to both Nick Bryant and John DeCamp that he was hired by King to photograph adults and children in compromising positions. He also named famous politicians as pedophiles and implied that the pictures were used as blackmail. Additionally, in one of Alicia Owens' tape testimonies collected by Gary Caradori, she describes the photographer who took pictures of her tied up in Larry King's apartment exactly as what Rusty Nelson looked like at the time. This is corroborated by another victim who described a man who looked like Rusty Nelson. Both describe Rusty as having blonde hair, average build, approximately 27 years old, and that he had acne scars on his face. Another teen and her mother, who attended the photography session with her daughter and got a very bad vibe and eventually left with her daughter and phoned the police, described him the same way and was able to provide his name, Rusty Nelson. The girl's mother had a feeling that had she not been there, her daughter would have been in a very bad position. Additionally, this session was held in the Twin Towers at Larry King's apartment. Troy Bonner, Danny King, and Paul Benassi, some of the male victims of the ring we will delve into next episode, also corroborate these stories with their own encounters with Rusty Nelson. And, once again, Rusty Nelson is not denying it. In his recorded, on-the-record interview with Nick Bryant, Nelson claimed that King attempted to pressure him into making snuff films, and that that was the end of their relationship, as he denied King's request. Rusty Nelson then claimed that he was then allegedly harassed by the FBI and that the harassment wasn't to get him to reveal Larry King's pedophile ring and the eminent politicians involved, but to instead silence him. Nick Bryant and John DeCamp also corroborate most of what Nelson said with other evidence. Though Nick said Nelson could be a shifty liar, but most of what he said was true, and also, who would lie about being a photographer for a child pedophile ring? That's not something you just toss around. Additionally, Nelson did time in prison for child pornography and was a registered sex offender from that point on. Gary Caradore also made contact with Rusty Nelson as part of his investigation, and both Rusty Nelson and Gary's wife Sandy confirm that Gary was set to meet Rusty Nelson in Chicago on July 9, 1990. Gary and his 8-year-old son AJ set out for Chicago from Lincoln, Nebraska, in his 1984 single-engine Piper Saratoga to attend the All-Star baseball game, but also to have a quick meetup with Rusty Nelson. I guess I find it a little strange that Gary would feel comfortable with his son around Rusty, but I guess if he was there, what could happen, you know? It's just odd, but I don't know. Maybe he just wanted to kill two birds with one stone, and Rusty Nelson happened to be in Chicago. During Gary's trip, he made phone calls to his wife, Sandy, Washington Times reporter Paul Rodriguez, who Gary had become close with and confided in about the case, Senator Lauren Schmidt, and Donna Owen, Alicia Owen's mom. According to Nick Bryant's book, Paul Rodriguez reported that Caradore, quote, unequivocally told Rodriguez that he was on the verge of acquiring pictures and other materials that would corroborate the victim's stories. The calls Caradore placed to his wife, Schmidt, and Owen didn't overtly mention the pictures because he undoubtedly thought their phones were tapped, unquote. Caradore's call to his wife cryptically conveyed to her that his Chicago trip had been a success. He also had a pithy conversation with Schmidt that he later relayed to a reporter. Lauren, we got them by the short hairs. Caradore, having talked to Alicia and Owen's parents on various occasions since initially interviewing their daughter, felt terrible about the horrors that had befallen her, and he told Donna Owen that she would be, quote, the happiest mother in the world upon his return from Chicago. Nelson claimed to Nick Bryant that in Chicago, quote, I met with Caradore briefly. I gave him pictures and I got out of there, end quote. Nick also said that in 2003, when he originally interviewed Rusty Nelson, he actually broke down and started to bawl as he described his rendezvous with Caradore. I can see why, because what happened next is utterly heart-wrenching. On the night of July 10th, Caradore and his son AJ attended the All-Star game, which ended around 11:45 p.m., and they flew out of Chicago's Midway Airport at 1:51 a.m. on July 11th. Approximately an hour later, Caradore's plane crashed in the cornfield of a farmer named Harold Cameron. After Cameron heard the sound of a plane and then an explosion, he drove around his property looking for the crash site. But it was dark, and the 4-foot-high corn obscured the wreckage. The plane was spotted at daybreak by a medical helicopter, and deputies from the Lee County Sheriff's Department were the first responders to the crash site, where they found the remains of Gary and AJ Caradore. Parts of the plane were scattered up to 1,800 feet from the fuselage, and the National Transportation Safety Board stated almost immediately that Caradore's plane, quote, broke up in flight, because it was strewn over such a vast area. But the exact mechanism for the plane's breakup was, quote, unknown. Speculation is all over the place with his plane crash, but one thing that Nick Bryant reports is that while writing his book, he had gotten to know Sandy Caradore over a 6-year period, and he, quote, finds her credibility to be unimpeachable. Meaning, if Sandy Caradore claimed he was meeting with Nelson before leaving Chicago, Gary Caradore was meeting Nelson in Chicago. Additionally, her account is doubly corroborated by Paul Rodriguez, who Gary had also phoned and who backs up that Gary explicitly told him he was acquiring photos from Nelson. And Schmidt told the Associated Press that Caradore had been in the process of trying to obtain pornographic pictures of the alleged victims. Schmidt also later revealed, after the crash, that in an affidavit, that he had been warned that Caradore's life was in danger. He also wrote a letter to the NTSB regarding the back seats of Caradore's plane that were never recovered. Quote, I do not know anything about sabotage, but I have been told that a phosphorus-type bomb would, in fact, vaporize metal and any other material with which it came into contact with, Unless someone knew what they were looking for, it would be difficult, if not impossible, to detect. I'm sure there will be those who will scoff at such a suggestion, but there have been entirely too many violent deaths associated with this investigation. In addition to the wreckage being strewn over a several-mile radius, a fact I personally asked a pilot I knew while researching this, who stated that that had to mean that the plane essentially exploded in flight. There were also very telling items missing from the wreckage, and a statement from the farmer, Harold Cameron, stating he heard, while huddled around the fuselage with local law enforcement after the plane was located, an officer stated, quote, "We better get the FBI involved." The Lee County coroner said that the FBI would only investigate the crash if there were signs of sabotage. And 2 days after the crash, the National Transportation Safety Board and the Lee County Sheriff announced that the crash entailed no signs of foul play. So it's rather baffling that local law enforcement apparently discussed FBI involvement at the crash site. Items were apparently recovered from the crash site and delivered to Sandy Caradori, but there were a few things notably missing. AJ's little backpack and Caradori's 35mm camera were relatively undamaged and given to Sandy. But the film in Caradori's camera had been taken out and then later returned to her after authorities had developed and reviewed the photos without explanation. Caradori's sturdy leather briefcase, which was a birthday present from his wife, was never returned. Ormiston told Nick Bryant that the briefcase was virtually an extension of Caradori. It almost, quote, never left his side throughout the Franklin investigation. If Caradori had scored pictures in Chicago, she felt, they definitely would have been in his briefcase. I'm going to close out this episode with a few short words in interviews with Sandy Caradori and Gary's brother from the Conspiracy of Silence documentary. Listen here.
The bodies of Gary Caradori and 8-year-old AJ were found in the wreckage.
National Transportation Safety Board investigators say wreckage from the crash is apparently strewn over a 3/4 to 1 mile long stretch in this field.
The fact that the wreckage is scattered over a large area certainly demonstrates that it did break up in flight. The exact mechanism of breakup yet is still unknown.
The federal investigation was never able to discover what tore the plane apart.
There are things missing from the plane. His briefcase is missing. Again, we'll never know what all was missing because I don't know what he had with him. I don't know what he did in Chicago. He may have had information he was coming back with.
Within 24 hours of the tragedy, FBI agents impounded all records of the investigation. Gary's widow, Sandy, is still unable to come to terms with her loss.
As a mother, I don't want to ever think that somebody murdered my child, let alone my husband. But I think if you'd ever talk to any parent, be it mother or father, that's ever lost a child, I mean, the worst thing that you can think of is that somebody would want to murder a child.
I really feel that somebody killed my brother. And inside me, I know that somebody killed my brother. If somebody could help us out somewhere, somebody knows something. And may God help those who did that to him and his family.
Gary Caradori's death pricked Troy Bonner's conscience. He promised Sandy that he would recant his recantation and tell the truth.
I set the record straight. I was, you know, going to do it. And would, you know, the truth would come out, you know, and somebody would be held accountable for his death. And then at the funeral, I had seen, you know, FBI guys, you know, and they looked at me. You know, I was supposed to meet Senator Levitz and Schmidt for lunch after the funeral. And, you know, that's when I decided, I told my mom, you know, we're not going to do the lunch. We're going to hightail it out of Lincoln now.
Next week, we will meet new victims, delve into Boys Town, connect stories not reported on in the Franklin scandal, and we will corroborate and connect even more victim stories. Thank you guys so much for listening, and if you're enjoying the show, please tell a friend. Leave a 5-star rating and positive review on Apple Podcasts. It really helps the show. Bye.